Hello, my friends. You are listening to Lynn Saunders, the host of Cherokee Conversations, and you are listening to 102.9 FM, Cherokee County's only Christian radio station. And welcome. I am so glad you're here. This is going to be a very different type of a conversation, whereas I don't have anybody else that we're going to be talking to except you. So this is a great conversation for you and I to just dive in and continue our celebration of our 250th year for us to celebrate together our 250th anniversary of our beloved country, the United States of America. Over the last few weeks, you have been listening to a couple of great interviews that I have had with my good friend, Colonel Quinton Thomas. He's a retired colonel. And for anything American history, I tend to run to Quentin and I say, please, can I interview you? And we've got two great interviews under our belt, which are on the homepage, by the way, mygraceradio.com, if you want to go and listen to those separately. Quentin, he did an outstanding job of setting up the Declaration of Independence, followed by another interview, which kind of bookended the back end with the Constitution. Now, we are not at the 250th year of the Constitution just yet. There's a few more years before that. Constitution Day is in September, but I just kind of wanted to give that nice, tidy package. Well, being inquisitive and all the years of ministry and teaching and Bible study teaching and whatnot, I think I have adopted a core value of to always ask for the why behind the what. We know the what in many cases, but why? In the case of the ministry with Papa's Pantry, Encompass Ministries, in that case, we had people who didn't have enough food, and the questions were why? Did they not have a job? Did they have some illnesses or setbacks? Why couldn't they afford it? And the programs that evolved from those questions are really quite remarkable. In this case, the Declaration of Independence, okay, yeah, we had none, we know about it. We put our flags up in the front. We might even wear a flag pin on our lapel. But can we go back maybe into the conversation of what was our country like during those days when our founding fathers felt it necessary to make the Declaration of Independence? What was life like? So that's what our conversation is going to be about now. So you might want to just take a quick second. If you're a note taker, this would be the one to take notes on. I will be reading from my notes. So there are some dates and some names that that you might say, oh yeah, let me just look into that a little bit more or put that into my mental filing cabinet. But get yourself a glass of water, a cup of coffee, whatever, and then enjoy this. This is information to share with your kids, your grandkids, in case they don't know. I recently had lunch with my oldest granddaughter, and we were talking about this, which really was part of the impetus for me to do this particular segment because there were things that I probably learned in elementary school. And I'm not saying that you all forgot some history like I might have forgotten some history, but just saying the information is going to be out there today and it'll help us reflect to how far we have really come. Now, I will say that in this period of time in our country, communism and is starting to creep up in conversations on the news every single day. There's talk about abolishing our constitution and the presidency and the way that we have lived as a nation for 250 years. And I think it would be good and prudent for us to look back at what we were involved with and why we felt the need to become the independent capitalistic country that we have and enjoy today. Now, this is not Republican or Democrat conversation. This is not left or right. This is not right or wrong. This is just simply remembering and rehearsing the facts. That's what today is all about. So hopefully by now you've got your pen, your pencil, whatever way you're going to take notes, your coffee, your tea, your water, and we're just going to jump right in. So we know that the Declaration of Independence happened in 1776. What led up to this? Well, let's go back to about 100 years. About a century before this, we had the 13 colonies. Well, maybe we didn't have all 13 yet, but we had colonies. The country was a checkerboard. We had British. We were all British back in the day, and we had the British colonies. The Native Americans, with their many nations and tribes, were on this North American soil. We had the French that were also on this soil, and they had kind of established a pathway from Canada through the Great Lakes down to Louisiana, and they were fighting for that territory. Meanwhile, with the British and the colonists were wanting to expand. We wanted to go west, young men, if you will. And we were bumping up that French barrier. So the two superpowers of the day were the British, Britain, and the French. In the 1750s, this really became more of a clash. The British tried to get the French to just move along, let us have our territory going west. And interestingly enough, back in 1753, a 21-year-old, very young George Washington, who was a British soldier, was tasked with going to the French military to say, "Move along, son." That started the French Indian War. Now you might think, okay, I remember hearing about that in school. Who was fighting who? We were fighting the French, although the French did a much better job of making allies out of the American Indians and nations than we did. We, as British colonists, we were expanding, we were agricultural, we were cutting down forests wherever we could expand to, taking away from the Indian native lands. Meanwhile, the French, they were more of the furriers. They would trade skins with the Native Americans, and they had a much better, more trusted relationship, the Indians and the French. So when we say the French-Indian War, we were fighting the French and their allied Indian nations. So here we go. The two superpowers, like I said, were France and were Britain. So officially in 1754, the French and Indian War broke out, and it was on our soil. Now, if you're older than 25, 30, then you probably remember 9/11. And we thought back then, who would attack us on our soil? Wars are always supposed to be somewhere else, not here. And we have had the luxury of enjoying that until 9/11 and since 9/11. Well, back then, the war broke out on American soil. And we know that there were a lot of wars back at the development of our country, but this is one of them, the French-Indian War. It was really over territory and trade routes between the two competing empires who was going to succeed. So this whole thing ruined that symbiotic relationship that we kind of had with Britain. Now, up until that point, Britain kind of let us be our own capitalist. We were responsible for our own representation. They, a little tiny island over there in Europe, they were ruling this sliver of the eastern continent, and they kind of let us live and let live until this happened. When the clash broke out, that meant British troops came over here again, wanting to expand their territory, not just us, not just America's going to grow and thank you very much, but no, this was their territory. It was more than just a little border skirmish. It turned into a 9-year, what you would call a global conflict of the day. And American colonies, they fought right alongside the British soldiers. We don't hear about that too much as in American history. We know that we will get to a point in our conversation actually today, our militiamen are going to be fighting against the soldiers. But at this period of time, we were all fighting for the same goal, was to expand that territory. But the American colonists, they learned a lot from the British during this time about how to fight wars. When it came to the Indians, they knew their territory. They knew how to traverse it. They knew all the workarounds. And the non-Indian people, French and British, they depended on the Indians for that knowledge understanding. Now, we had some good relationships. I don't want to say that, the British had all the good relationships, but we had some with the East Coast Indians, in the Northeast. We want to also make sure that in our conversations, at this point in time, the Indians were not necessarily the victims or the target of this expanse. It was more Britain and the French. Back in 1754, both empires collided in the Ohio River Valley, which is today modern-day Western Pennsylvania, Ohio, and West Virginia. For Britain, it was prime real estate. For expanding the colonies, for France, it was really the critical highway to link their Canadian territories to their southern trade routes. It was economic for them. But in 1763, the British, they finally won. The colonists fought hard side by side, the British, and they won. So, being thrilled, they thought that they had the right to expand at that period of time into their new land. And they expected Britain to basically treat them with newfound respect because they helped Britain hold their own side by side. However, after the Treaty of Paris was signed, the French surrendered their territory and all their North American lands and handed it over to the British without ever really consulting their allies, the Indian nations. The Indians kind of got mad. They felt they were still at war. They did not sign a treaty. They did not have an agreement with Britain. And so they would go from British fort to fort to fort to fort to destroy it, killing hundreds of soldiers that were British soldiers and Americans at, well, I call it Americans, the British colonists that were also occupying those forts. So the war wasn't really over. So King George III in Britain panicked. And what he did was he said, oh no, he said, we are going to split, we're going to put a line straight down the Appalachians because that was sort of the boundary of the lands. Anything to the east of the Appalachians was pretty much British, and anything to the west was French or free game. They were not able to reap the fruit of their victory. After all, King George did not back the colonists. So, just like that, the war was over. Not only did the French betray the Indians, King George betrayed the colonists, his own British subjects. So, with that, Great Britain emerged from the war as the world's dominant superpower. But they were also at that point functionally bankrupt. War is expensive. This is really what triggered more and more of that avalanche of the separation and the hostilities between the colonist and Great Britain. Because Britain felt as if they had all these expenses to help the colonists, that the colonists then were responsible to pay Britain some tax money. And so, like never before, again, they had for 100 years before this, they had lived side by side-ish. Yes, the pond was between them, but there was no overreach or control. Now the taxes started, and it started with the Sugar Act. The politicians were there. It was like, hey, we spent a fortune defending those colonists from the French. It's only fair now that they start chipping in to pay for it. So, needing cash fast in 1764, that's when the Sugar Act began taxing the colonies for their sugar. A year later, then came the Stamp Act. So, we see one now coming right after the other. The Stamp Act is really a tax on everyday paper items. It was their newspapers, legal documents, even playing cards. The colonists' anger just increased. Before the war, they were seeming autonomous. Now, Britain was breaking its own constitutional rules. British citizens, the colonists were British citizens, were not supposed to be taxed unless their elected representatives voted for it. But they didn't have any representation. They had no representatives in Britain on their behalf. This sparked that rallying cry of no taxation without representation. You remember hearing about that. The colonists then began to boycott anything coming over from Britain, and it greatly hurt the merchants that were there. Their economies started to fail, their businesses started to fail. And at this point, it was still not even an organized boycott. It was just kitchen table to kitchen table of like, we are not supporting Britain because they have betrayed us to such a great point. 1 year later in 1766, because of the boycotts, the British Parliament then was forced to repeal the Stamp Act. So you would think the colonists would think, all right, we won. But on that very same day, the British Parliament slapped the colonists hard to say, all right, we're going to pass. And they did the Decatory Act. They did that to save face. And basically, what that was telling the colonies is, we are taking this specific tax away, the Which Tax? The Stamp Act. We're taking that tax away, but we still have total authority to pass whatever laws or taxes we want on you in the future, whenever we want. That was a paraphrase of what their message was, but that was the meaning of it. So we've got these British colonists going, okay, did we really win the war? Maybe just the battle, but is th what's coming next? Well, the following year in 1767, the Townshend Acts were established, adding even more taxes on everyday essentials, things like paint, glass, their tea. You know where we're going with this. Things escalated from political arguments at that point to then real world problems, and it got violent very quickly. Britain sent their troops to cities like Boston to occupy some of the major cities, and that didn't go very well, as you might expect. In 1770, now we're kind of 3 years after the Townshend Act, after they declared absolute rule. 1770, we had the Boston Massacre. You remember hearing that? And that was basically when the British soldiers who were already encamped now here, they fired into an angry crowd and killed five people. So now it was more than just money, it was blood, blood and treasure. Let's see, 1773, things literally boiled over with the Tea Act. The Britons passed a law granting a monopoly to the British East India Company in protest to the Tea Act. A group called the Sons of Liberty dressed up, sneaked onto British ships in the harbor, and dumped a fortune's worth of tea into the Boston Harbor. Now, we, of course, know that as the Boston Tea Party. Parliament, even though they thought that they had cracked down hard, they cracked down now even harder. In May of 1774, Britain passed the Coercive Acts, otherwise known as the Intolerable Acts. That completely shut down Boston's port. In Boston, it shut down everything. It banned local town meetings and forced regular citizens to house British soldiers in their homes. Now, can you imagine the government sending troops knocking on your door to say, by the way, we are going to live here in your house. You will feed us. You will clean up after us. Oh, you have herds and flocks. Yeah, we're going to take them whenever we want to. As you can imagine, the colonists were then highly, highly occupied, very, very restricted. It was like a situation that we just don't know as a people to exist in our country. But that was a major, major escalation, was when that became part of the everyday forced culture on the colonist. So, Britain thought that this tactic would then beat the colonies into submission, that they would just give up, but instead it united them. So what did they do? In 1774, we find the First Continental Congress, and that all is mumbo jumble in most of our heads. This was the first time in our nation's history where the colonies unified to become a delegation, a unified delegation against the British Crown, against King George III, because they were being brutalized, their families were being brutalized. And remember, there had never been anything like this before. Each one of the colonies legislated themselves. Now, they had their own leaders and who would be their lawmakers, and each one was very much independent. They were not a United States, they were independent colonies, British colonies. We just kind of think of who were these people and why. Of course, we know that they needed to unite. They needed to assemble to protect themselves from any more overreach from Britain, and how to defend themselves. Now, this was not an act of a declaration of independence by any stretch, not this first delegation at all. In fact, there was quite a lot of discussion between the delegates who were called. So kind of how that came together. The political heavy hitters in Virginia, that included Thomas Jefferson, that included Patrick Henry and Richard Henry Lee, and they met secretly. They met secretly at the Raleigh Tavern in Williamsburg. So all good things happen at tavern, right? But they did this to discuss the future of the colonies. Now they considered their options and they remembered an idea from 20 years before during the French Indian War that Benjamin Franklin pitched. And it was called the Albany Plan of Union. And in essence, it was a blueprint that unified the colonial government to speak as one. Back during the French Indian War, it got voted down. None of the colonies would come together. Why, you ask? Because they were threatened and jealous of each colony's political power. They just could not come together at all. But it wasn't as dire then. I mean, during the French Indian War, yes, the colonists were not strong enough, truthfully, to fight the French on their own or the British on their own. And Franklin had that insight to see that, which is why he presented it back when he did. But now things really had escalated, and it was time to go back, call the delegates from each one of the colonies, and there were 13. They decided to go ahead and come together just to talk about it, just to see what they could do for their options. In 1774, September 5th through October 26th, the First Continental Congress brought together 55 delegates from 12 of the 13 colonies. Now you might ask, who didn't show up to the table? Well, I'm sorry to tell you this, but it was Georgia. Georgia did not show up to the table. It was the only colony who did not attend. Now, at that time, Georgia was only 40 years old, so we were the youngest of the territories, and we were the most sparsely populated of the British colonies. But we also had a very good relationship with Britain. We were kind of further separated from the northern territories, the northern colonies, and we had a thriving export business to London with things like rice, indigo, lumber. We were sending that across the ocean and making a fortune, and they were benefiting. Britain was benefiting from that relationship. But we also, at that period of time in 1774, Georgia was heavily engaged with protecting borders from our American Indian nations. The colony was entirely dependent on British soldiers that were stationed in Georgia for protection and to help fight those battles. Otherwise, Georgia could have been wiped out because they did not have the strength of the northern colonies to help them. If Georgia had sided with the rebel Congress, who was calling for the boycott of Great Britain, that seemed like suicide financially and physically. The king would pull his troops if they had done that, and they would have been completely defenseless against the Indians. The majority of the Georgia leadership said no, but it was Georgia's Governor Wright who successfully blocked it. And how did he block it? He prevented the legislation from voting. So they didn't even have a vote in this. But at the end result, none of the official legislators or political leaders in Georgia went to the First Continental Congress meeting and event in Philadelphia. However, there is a little bit of good news here. I'm going to read you a story. I hope you'll just stay with me. Even though the colony of Georgia officially stayed home, one radical pocket of the state refused to be silenced. A single county named St. John's Parish, which is near modern-day Midway, Georgia, was so frustrated by the colony's hesitation that they went rogue. They independently elected a physician named Dr. Lyman Hall and sent him to Philadelphia all by himself. He wasn't allowed to vote because he didn't represent the whole colony, but he didn't show up empty-handed. He arrived at the First Continental Congress hauling barrels of Georgia rice to feed the starving families of Boston who were being blockaded by the British Navy. It was a legendary gesture of solidarity that foreshadowed Georgia finally joining the revolution the very next year. So, at least that's a little heartwarming that the Georgians kept them alive. All right, so back to the First Continental Congress. Who were they? There were 55 delegates that were gathered at Carpenter's Hall in Philadelphia for 7 weeks. And these people represented a delicate balance of political views. They debated and they argued. The colonies were very much divided on how to handle Great Britain. We had radicals like Samuel Adams. You remember I mentioned the Boston Tea Party and the Sons of Liberty? Well, Samuel Adams, who was John Adams' cousin, he was a leader in that organization of the Radical Sons of Liberty. He wanted to take an aggressive, hardline stance against Parliament immediately. But then you had quite the opposite voices in the room, the moderates, the conservatives, men like John Jay. He was a conservative lawyer who excelled at diplomacy. He also co-authored the Federalist Papers. And John Jay wanted to avoid war at all cost and find a legal, diplomatic way to patch things up with King George III. So you can see that we've got a lot of personalities to the very right, to the very left. But we had some other names, and I'm not going to go through all the 55 people. No, not at all. But we had George Washington. You remember George Washington? He was our first president, as it turned out. Very much a commanding and trusted leader. Patrick Henry from Virginia. You remember, give me liberty or give me death. He's the one who said that in the Second Continental Congress. John Adams, brilliant, fierce constitutional lawyer. He served as America's second president after George Washington, and his term of service was set 1797 to 1801. That'll give you some idea of just how influential these delegates were who came together. They were intentionally brought in to be voices of reason, voices of political integrity, insight, strategies, but to keep balanced heads. The leaders were a little bit more open-minded to accept that they just could not go back to their colonies with their tails between their legs, that they had to be part of this movement, this unified movement, whatever that looked like. And it did, it had to evolve. But they eventually voted on how to handle Great Britain before they were able to head home before the winter. Because back then, you didn't travel much in the winter if you could avoid it. The First Continental Congress, they walked out with two things, a Declaration of Rights and the Articles of Association. These documents were designed really to squeeze Britain economically until they treated the colonists like equal citizens. However, King George did not listen. He wouldn't even look at it. He didn't even look at the document. But because he knew that the colonies were now unified and they were putting out documents like this, he established war. He was backed into a corner. He was not going to try diplomacy with these colonists. That ship had sailed because of all of the taxes and all the infighting and the escalations by Britain. There was just no diplomacy on Britain's path. He had to save face. The king chose to fight. He declared the colonies to be in open rebellion. The British Army then marched into Concord. I mean, we know that story. April 1775, that was when the shot was heard around the world, happened, became the fuse basically that lit the American Revolution. They were revolting against Britain. During that, what kind of led up to that confrontation is Britain decided, oh, these colonists, they are organized. They're going to fight us. We're going to seize all of their weapons. And so there was an out and out. I mean, we enjoy that Second Amendment, our protection of defending ourselves with our weapons. And this is the root of that. They had openly, weapons back in the day to defend themselves against probably animals more than people. But then as the wars started to escalate, they needed those weapons. And when the government said, we're going to take away your weapons, the colonists revolted. So anyway, armed colonial militia fighters, these are our young men in boots. They clashed with the British soldiers who were trying to take their weapons, and that's how the war started. So even after a year of actual warfare and thousands of casualties, many of the colonists were still terrified of a permanent breakup with Britain. From May to June 1775, the Second Continental Congress meets. Colonial leaders gathered in Philadelphia again. Now, they left Philadelphia in 1774. They went home for the winter. Now they're back. It's May. May and June, here they are trying to do that Second Continental Congress. They had to form an official army because they were at war. We had the Battle of Bunker Hill in July and August of that same year. Toward the end of the summer, they had final attempts at peace. There was an olive branch petition where our Congress made a final offer of peace, pledging loyalty to King George if he addressed their grievances. Instead, he declared the colonies to be in open rebellion. 1776, January, anxiety was vanished on the part of the colonists when Thomas Paine published a booklet called Common Sense. Plainly written in fiery language, regular people loved what he had to say, and it changed public opinion about going to war. He argued that a tiny island like Britain had no business ruling an entire continent. It became an instant bestseller and paved the way toward the Declaration of Independence. The writing of the Declaration of Independence, we know that that happened from June to July of 1776. The Congress appointed a committee of five. The interview with Quinton Thomas talked all about that. Again, that interview is on the website, mygraceradio.com, on that homepage for you to listen to. But the committee of five was led by Thomas Jefferson, and he wrote the draft statement explaining the reasons for separation. Independence was declared. Our Congress voted to approve independence on July 2nd, 1776, and officially adopted the Declaration of Independence on July 4th, 1776. This is part one. I was hoping to try to get through the actual reading of the Declaration of Independence today, but we're going to do that next week. And I am looking at and kind of interpreting it. There's a lot there in the Declaration of Independence. And without understanding what I talked about today, it just kind of rolls off the back of our heads. And, okay, yeah, that was then. Now it's now. But I wanted to bring you up to date with what the colonists were going through day to day, year by year, as Britain continued to escalate their overreach and their tyranny on the colonists, and what drove the colonists to say enough is enough. And so when we talk next week about the, and I'll decipher and interpret what the Declaration means line by line, if that might be, or paragraph by paragraph. And at the end of next week's conversation, which I'm calling next week, the interview, my Cherokee conversation, we're going to be having a conversation with the Declaration of Independence. So I hope you enjoyed the content for today. I thank you for staying and hanging in here for this half hour. And I hope that you are looking forward to finishing up our conversation next week. Put it on your calendar. God bless you. God bless America. Bye.